Dear Jesus, may I enter into the eternal divine order of God to place my absolute nothingness in the heart of the Most Holy Trinity, to give to my God the joy of fulfilling the purpose of my existence by doing all the acts of my life through the Immaculate Heart of my Mother Mary and in the divine will of God. And in this same manner may I live, pray, act, eat, walk, sleep, and do everything. May my soul be devoid of any other longings, wants, or desires, and may you, my beloved divine will, do with me whatever you want or desire. All I ask is that you bind me to your most holy will so intimately that I may never swerve from carrying out what I know to be your good pleasure, and that I remain so docile to the movements of your divine will that you never perceive even a breath of resistance in my soul to your requests of me. Come, divine will, with all the angels and saints, especially my sweet Mother Mary, to touch my forehead, to imprint on it the Holy Spirit and infuse in me true light, so that I may understand the truths and the good that are in these writings and prayers. Amen. We want to begin with September the 5th, 1926, this evening, and the Lord is going to talk to us about the vast paternity that we have in the divine will. Louisa said, "I was feeling oppressed, or rather as though lifeless because of the privation of my sweet Jesus." We have said often that Louisa is literally living a miraculous life. So if Jesus appears to withdraw from her, all her ability to survive actually withdraws as well, because he is the one sustaining her physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. "This pain is always new," she said, "and ever more piercing, in such a way as to form new wounds and to make my poor soul bleed with pain." Now, to have your body bleeding with pain is bad enough. To have your soul bleeding with pain is something that many of us may not have any experience of. Soul pain is beyond description. It's an awful lot worse than heartrending. Only someone who has experienced soul pain could have any idea of how terrifying it actually is. "Now, while I was in this nightmare," that's why she would call it a nightmare, "of the pain of his privation, my beloved Jesus moved in my interior." That's because the kingdom of God is within you, Luke 17:21. And 1 Corinthians 3:16, "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" So he moved in my interior, clasping me to his most holy heart. I've always said he's very good at the hugs. Telling me, "My daughter," well, look at the titles he's going to give her. "Our daughter," that's the daughter of the Most Holy Trinity, "the daughter of our celestial mother, the daughter of the angels, the daughter of the saints, the daughter of the heavens, the daughter of the sun, the daughter of the stars, the daughter of the sea. In sum, you are the daughter of all." So she's the daughter of everyone who is in the divine will. Notice that in the kingdom of the divine will, there is absolute unity and all are for one and one is for all. All of them are fathers to you. Now, the word father in English means your origin or where you actually come from. And so we have actually come from the divine will. And when we go back into the divine will, we're going back into our origin. And so all others who are in the divine will, they all participate in giving us life. "How long is your daughtership?" he said. "Instead of oppressing yourself, you should delight." Now, she's in desperate pain, so, you know, he's asking a lot. But since her daughtership is so great, I want to give you again Romans 8:19, because it's these sons or daughters of God that the whole of the world, as well as the whole of humanity, will be restored. "So instead of oppressing yourself, you should delight, thinking that all are fathers to you. You are the daughter of all." But of course, if you're in this vast, terrible soul pain, you're not able to think like that. The only thing that is in your consciousness is this shocking pain. "Only one who lives in my will can have the right to such a vast paternity." Now, he's giving us a lot of reasons in volume 19 to really get into divine will if we have hesitated. Only one who lives in my will can have the right, notice the word right, to such a vast paternity and such a long daughtership, to be loved by all with paternal love. Now, to be loved by the Father, to be loved by the Son, to be loved by the Spirit, to be loved by the Mother of Humanity, to be loved by all the saints, to be personally loved by all the angels. It really is incredible. But he's also saying to be loved by all the parts of creation as well. Now, we're living at a time of great distress where the world is actually in rebellion against the human being, because we are in rebellion as a society. We are in rebellion against the will of God. But someone who has come right into the will of God, everything is restored. And so they all come to give life and fellowship to this person, because they all recognize in her their daughter. The thing they all have in common is the divine will reigning in them. In fact, such created things are all invested with my will, which he has told us over and over again. So wherever the divine will reigns as triumphant and dominating, in other words, it has a true reign, they see in you the same will that reigns in them, and therefore all hold you as the daughter of their wombs. It's this recognition. We've noticed this among ourselves as well, that people living or trying to live in the divine will, there is an immediate recognition of who's who. We actually recognize one another, even if we don't know the person's name or what country they come from. It doesn't seem to matter, because this is way above that, this wonderful reality. And so there is this inner recognition of all those who live in the divine will. There are so many bonds between you and them as to surpass in an infinite way, notice the word infinite, the natural bonds that exist between Father and Son. So this is a bonding that we begin to recognize, but we have got to go deeper and deeper into its reality so that we can benefit from it. Do you know who is not your Father? Only those who do not let my will reign in them. And you can recognize them very easily, unfortunately. These have no right over you, nor do you have any duty towards them. They are like something that doesn't belong to you. Now, I find that absolutely amazing that that statement is made there, that Louisa has no duty to anybody outside of the divine will. The mission that was given to her was to be the head of the mission to the divine will. So she was only told that those within the divine will would come under her umbrella. Having said that, all prayers in the divine will are for absolutely everyone. They are universal, because divine love doesn't have borders. Divine life doesn't have borders. And so with the vast number of people who are in fact outside of the divine will, they are covered completely by the intercessions and prayers of those in the divine will. But Louisa was told they particularly were not her concern. We were the ones who would try and live in the divine will, that she had to sort of make a way for us. But do you know what it means to possess such a vast paternity, Jesus said, at such a long daughtership? It means to be bound with bonds of justice to all the riches, glory, honour and privileges that such a vast paternity possesses. Notice bonds of justice. In other words, if you truly are united with the divine will, and if the divine will is really reigning in you and having its dominating power working in you and through you, that you have a right to all of this, because that is for everyone and everything in the divine will. So, as my daughter, your Jesus gives you all the goods of redemption as gifts. Now, if you have your own book in front of you, begin listing these out. It's really incredible what he says. So, as my daughter, we would say my special daughter, because you're in the divine will, your Jesus gives you all the goods of redemption. Now, people who are not in the divine will are not capable of reaching out for all the goods of redemption. They may, in fact, take very little. I mean, think of someone who waits almost to their deathbed to even take the most basic thing as forgiveness, to enter and re-enter into that relationship. Now, for someone to receive all the goods of redemption, it's absolutely astonishing, because only our Blessed Mother was able to do that before, because of her position in grace and in the divine will. As our daughter, that's the daughter of the Blessed Trinity, you are endowed with all the goods of the Most Holy Trinity. Now, all you can do with that is take it off the page, write it down, and say, Lord, open my mind to understand this, open my heart to grasp it. As a daughter or a son of the Most Holy Trinity, you are endowed with all the goods. And you know, we've been told in all the passages coming up to this particular passage, that when the Most Holy Trinity gives, all he and they can give is what they have, who they are. And that's all of the divine attributes poured into us insofar as we can take them. As daughter of the Sovereign Queen, she gives you her sorrows, her works, her love, and all her maternal merits as gifts. Now notice he puts sorrows first. Louisa is the head of a mission, and therefore she has to bear the sorrows of that mission. Our Blessed Mother was the mother of all humanity. She had to bear all the sorrows that went with her position. Jesus, as the Redeemer, had to bear all the sorrows of humanity as well. And you might be surprised that that is the first thing that is offered. And also her works, her love, and all of her maternal merits. As daughter of the angels and of the saints, they compete among themselves to give you all of their goods. As daughter of the heavens, the stars, the sun, and the sea, and all created things, they feel honoured to finally have their daughter and to be able to give their inheritance. That's why it's so important to do the rounds, so that you are actually including all the different aspects of creation. I always say that the rounds are really my signature on each part of creation and each part of redemption and sanctification, so that the Lord knows that my signature is there as well, saying yes and claiming everything for everyone. So, and my very will reigning in the angels and the saints with its endless light forms for you the deed of all creation, and all feel the happiness, the joy of being able to give their inheritance, because by being able to give, they no longer feel sterile. Now, notice in all that Jesus says about the Most Holy Trinity, he keeps on saying they want to give, they want to give, they want to give. Now, you look at the world today, and it's in exactly the opposite direction. It wants to take, it wants to take, it wants to take. And the sign of someone who has really turned to God and to love and to life is that you begin to give and give and give. And you'll notice this in the saints as well. So he's saying that when a person comes deeply enough into the divine will, it is an incredible joy for the angels and saints to be able to give to us. And so they no longer feel sterile, but they feel fertile with a fecundity that brings joy and company and harmony and glory and the repetition of one's very life. But of course, God intended us all to be in his divine will from the very beginning, from the time of Adam. He intended us to experience all that he wanted to give to us. And so when the angels and the saints are allowed to share that, it's the abundance that they are experiencing they want to share with us. And so the angels and the saints want us to succeed in reaching the goal much more than I think we ourselves do. How many fathers and mothers are unhappy even though they are rich, because they've no offspring, they've nobody to give everything to. In fact, sterility in itself brings isolation and bitterness and lack of any support or of happiness. And if it may appear that they enjoy, in their hearts there is the thorn of sterility that embitters all of their enjoyments. Unfortunately, society can degenerate to the point where they actually cultivate sterility, which is what's happening today. It's a very great deterioration of humanity. So, your vast paternity which you possess, and your long daughtership, is a cause of joy for all, because all of these groups and all of these persons are all pouring out upon you. And much more for my will, which by locating in you, reigns in you. I mean, look at that wonderful statement, that the divine will is reigning in heaven and reaches a point where it can also reign in this little nothing on the earth as well. But it's an incredible victory for the Lord to reign in this little nothing, because this little nothing has to hand over its will in order for that reign to happen. In heaven, he has already conquered everything. It is on the earth that he is in the process of conquering. So it's the most wonderful thing that the divine will reigning in heaven would reign completely and totally in me as well. And much more for my will, which by locating reigns in you and constitutes you the daughter of all the things created by it. Notice it gives you ownership of the creation. In such a way that all feel your support and the contentment of being able to give the goods that they possess. Therefore, Jesus says to her, your oppression is not justified in the midst of so many goods. Now, if Louisa was on the other side, outside of the flesh, in the spirit, of course, this would make enormous sense. But since she is absolutely crippled with pain, it's interesting the way Jesus is speaking. But he's telling us that we need to begin to try and appreciate spiritual realities instead of just staying with material realities around us. Therefore, your oppression is not justified in the midst of so many goods, of so much happiness, and of so many who protect you, defend you, and love you. Now, look at that. The Most Blessed Trinity, our Blessed Mother, all the angels and the saints are each protecting us, defending us and loving us as their true sons and daughters, all of us trying to live in the divine will. That's absolutely fantastic. So Louisa goes on. After this, she said, I abandoned myself in the arms of Jesus and in the current of the divine will to do my usual acts. I love the way she can go from a complete crisis to Jesus revealing something to her, and then she gets on with her business of what she should do in praying and interceding anyway. She's able to move very quickly from one to the other, which tells you she's a very free soul. She's very detached. She's not clinging onto anything. And she's not even clinging to her pain or the need that it creates. So she abandons herself in the arms of Jesus. And that's exactly what we need to do in every circumstance of our lives. We must trust him beyond reason. And as time goes on, and things get worse in the earth, and the Antichrist manifests on the earth, which he will do in a short time, we have to trust God beyond reason and throw ourselves in the arms of Jesus, as Louisa is doing here. Everything will be fine. Everything will be fine. And Jesus said to her, my daughter, my will preserves the soul in her origin. So going back into the divine will, we're going back into our origin, to that relationship that the human race had before the fall. And it does not allow her to go out of her beginning, which is God. Now, there's a certain point at which our commitment in the divine will is permanent. Only you and God know that moment. And so you are brought back to your origin and you are not allowed to go out of it. You remember Louisa has often described herself as going into this vast sea of light and there's no way out of it. There's no way you could measure the extent of it or anything else. You are there in this presence, which is God, because God is light. 1 John 1:5. So once we reach this point, he won't let you go back. He protects you from your own weaknesses. The divine will maintains intact the divine image in the depth of her being. Now, the divine image was given to us in Genesis 1:27, Genesis 2:7, and Paul tells us in Romans 8:29 that we are to be the image of the Son. So, coming back into our origin, back into this original relationship with God, we have to come back into this image that God created of himself. And he will maintain that divine image intact once we are permanently in that position. We're not moving in and out of the divine will. So it maintains the divine image intact in the depths of her being, which is enclosed in her intellect, memory, and will. Now, the hardest bit to get shifting is the will, but the intellect has to be fed. And we have come across this in the whole 19 volumes that we have looked at, that the intellect must continuously be fed with this revelation that the Lord is giving, so that it will gradually come round and be completely convinced that the only thing to do, not just the right thing, but the only thing to do, is to surrender to the divine will and to let the divine will take over. And so the intellect absolutely must be fed. And we're used to Louisa saying to us, you know, he told me something through a light. That means infused knowledge. And so we must let the Lord do that with us as well, because he's not a respecter of persons. So this image is enclosed in her intellect, memory, and will. And as long as the soul allows my divine will to reign in her, everything is links. Everything is in relationship between the creator and the creature. Everything depends on that connection between our will and the divine will. Even more, she lives in the reflections of the supreme majesty, and our likeness in her grows continuously. Read St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, chapter 1, verses 11 to 14. So we have to grow more and more and more in the likeness of Christ. So I keep saying to you as we go through these volumes that we are given moments at which we can recognize whether we have moved. Because this is one of these moments, maybe I should call them discernment moments, because we ourselves have to recognize at what point I have moved beyond the point of no return. There's a very important moment in a flight. It's the point of no return. You must continue. There's absolutely no way you can go back. And there's a point of no return in our giftedness to the divine will as well. And it's when you shift beyond that, everything comes into position. Everything falls into place. Everything makes sense. And you will know, because you will realize if you look back, I'm different to what I was last year. I'm not the same. I don't think the same. I don't respond the same way. The Lord has a much greater hold on me. He's center. He's there all the time. I don't even have to decide to get into the presence of God. It's there all the time. And I'm conscious of him and conscious of the fact that he is moving and he is doing whatever he wants to do. These are just discernment moments for you that I like to give you. So even more, she lives in the reflections of the supreme majesty, and our likeness in her grows continuously. Therefore, that presence has got to be recognized. And this makes her be distinguished as our daughter. On the other hand, the human will causes her to deny her origin. It makes her decay from her beginning. Her intellect, memory, and will remain without light, and the divine image remains deformed and unrecognizable. So here we are going downhill as fast as we can now. The human will breaks all the divine bonds and relationships, and therefore it makes the soul live in the reflections of all the passions. So if you find yourself descending into the passions, then you're really in the wrong direction. In such a way that she becomes ugly. And she becomes the daughter of the infernal enemy who tries to engrave his ugly image in her. How many evils does one's will not cause? It devastates every good and produces all evils. Now, you're being told two absolutes here. One is the sheer glory of being transformed in God. And the other one is the terrifying possibility of being deformed in Satan's image. And so when he gives us these comparisons, it really helps us to shift. So Jesus is now going to give us a picture of what he has just said, because he knows that we will get something better if it's illustrated than if it's just given with intellectual information. So after this, blessed Jesus brought me outside of myself, showed me how deformed his image had become in creatures. You're talking about 1926. It's almost 100 years ago. Things are infinitely worse now. it was horrifying to see it so unrecognizable and ugly. Now, Jesus has pointed out that if we move away from his image, we actually do become ugly spiritually. The sanctity of the gaze of Jesus was reluctant to look at them. That's Habakkuk 1:13. Lord, your gaze is too holy to look upon sin. But the compassion of his most holy heart pushed him to have pity on the works of his hands, deformed into being so ugly, but because of their own fault and their own decision. And while Jesus was grieved to the summit in seeing his image deformed in this way, my book says transformed, and that's a wrong use of that word, transformed. It should be deformed. And seeing his image so deformed, we arrived at some place in which the offences which were given to him were so many that, unable to take any more, he changed his appearance of goodness, assuming the aspect of justice. Now, he has to go onto the justice side. I've told you many times that, like children, we live between two limits. A child lives between the hugs and the affirmation of the parent and the discipline of the parent. And if the child keeps on going towards the discipline of the parent, the child will experience the parent as very severe. But the child who cooperates and can learn and can obey the parent will only experience the hugs and the affirmation. And so you can have two children in one family who think the parents were completely different. And it's the same in society. People who obey the law don't ever come up against the severity of the law. But those who rebel against the law know about courts and prisons and arrest and all the rest of it. And it's the same in our relationship with God. We can live surrendered to him and only know his mercy and love, like St. Therese of Lisieux. And there are others who only seem to know the severity of God because they've moved in the wrong direction. And it's very important for us to just use these images, because people can misunderstand when they see the severity of God. There has to be limits. There has to be parameters. And so when humanity moves in this direction of being deformed and so unlike anything that has to do with God, chastisement is the only thing that can happen to try and put some correction into the system to see if some souls can be saved. Otherwise, they'll all be lost. And that's a tragedy you don't want to even consider. So he threatened chastisements, and earthquakes, water and fire were put out against the people to destroy men and cities. Well, that's happening all around us. This is everyday news. I prayed him to spare the people, and Jesus, taking me back into bed, shared his pains with me. In other words, helped her to go into reparation to try and save souls. Okay, so let's come to September the 7th, 1926. And here we learn why it is that the human will is so important. Because we're told here that the human will is a spark made from the tip of the rays of the supreme volition. In other words, the human will was made as a spark from God. And so he cannot bear to have that spark absolutely destroyed and deformed. Because if the human will is in its right place in its relationship with God, that human person will experience only wonder and glory and love, which is divine, infinite, eternal. So Louisa said, I was about to resume my flight in the supreme volition to make my usual visit in the kingdom of the divine will and to extend myself within its boundaries in order to let my I love you, my adoration, my thank you echo for each created thing. I call that putting your name and your signature on absolutely everything that God created. Now, as I was about to do this, I thought to myself, if God is everywhere, the Psalm 139, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your face? If I go to the heavens, you are there. If I go into the depths of the darkness, even darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day. I've just given you a few tiny bits from it. Nice long psalm. It's a good one to read. So if God is everywhere, why do I have to take flight in the divine volition and to go up to the height of the heavens before the Supreme Majesty, as though carrying all human wills of the generations on my little lap, to do my act of subjection, love, and abandonment for each rebellious will. So if he's everywhere, why do I have to take this flight into the presence of God? In order to conquer the divine will to come and reign upon the earth, dominating and triumphant in the midst of creatures. Now, since the divine will is everywhere, I can do it from here. Now, that's not Louisa's problem. I've told you this over and over again. When Louisa goes into a thing like this, she's actually voicing our problems, our difficulties, the way we would think. She doesn't need this at all. And the Lord has told her that he puts these ideas into her head so that he can give her the answer for us. Because if you actually had this problem today, who would you turn to? Who is there to help us? There is nobody. The church is in crisis. Okay? So the Lord put the question into her so that he could provide the answer before we ever asked the question. So why can't I do it from here? So while I was thinking of this, my sweet Jesus moving in my interior told me, my daughter, look at the sun. Its light descends and fills the whole earth, but the sun remains always up there, 39,000 million miles away, under the vault of the heavens, with all majesty in its sphere, lording and dominating over everyone and everything with its light. In other words, the sun does its wonderful work because it stays in the position that God put it into, the absolute correct position for us. But even though it doesn't descend down below, it gives the same effects. It communicates the same goods by means of its rays, as if it itself would descend from the height of its sphere. More so because if the sun descended, watch this now, he's actually saying a lot that's going to come up after this. If the sun actually did descend, it would ignite the earth. The sun would be a devouring fire if it came too close to the earth. The scientists are always looking at the flares of the sun in case any of them came too close to the earth because they can do devastation on the earth. So the sun is at maximum benefit for us if it keeps its distance, or as Jesus would say here, its height. Okay, so if it descended, it would ignite and eclipse everything with its light and with its heat. But since all things created by me contain the similarity with the bosom of mercy of its creator, the sun remains where it is, emitting its rays full of goodness, love, and goods for the little earth. Now, I want to give you a couple of references for where we're going with this, because if the sun actually came too close, it would just burn the whole earth up. So I want to give you Hebrews 12:29. That is, our God is a consuming fire. He's going to explain this in a moment. And the very same thing is said in Deuteronomy 4:24. And it's said in a slightly different way in Isaiah 33:14, who could dwell among the everlasting burnings. So, because we go from the image of the sun to the divine will. Now, if the sun does this, and it's only an image of the true light of the divine sun, much more so does God, the true sun of light, of justice and of love. My majesty doesn't move from the height of its throne. In other words, God reigns from his throne. Now, if God comes to us in justice, he comes too close to us, we experience him as a consuming fire. That is the chastisement. So notice what he's going to say now. He's going to allow people in the divine will to actually go up to him on behalf of everyone else. So my majesty does not move from the height of its throne, but it's always firm and stable in its place, in its celestial royal palace, more than the sun. It emits its endless rays, which carry its effects and its goods, and communicates its very life as if itself would descend to those who want to receive it. So everything is done from this great height. So what it does not do by descending in person, it does through the emanation of its endless rays, bilocating in them to give its very life and its good to the human generations. Keep the image of the sun, It's sending these rays to the earth, and all the good that comes to the earth is coming in these rays. Now, these rays are very important because we're going to be told in the end that the tips of those rays created the human will. And that's why we should be absolutely connected with the source. Now, because of your condition as a creature, he says to Louisa, and because of your office, that's concerning her office as the head of a mission of the Supreme Fiat, it's your duty to go up on these rays that the Supreme Majesty emits, and to bring yourself before the Supreme Majesty and fulfill your office in the bosom of the Eternal Son, plunging into the origin from which you came, in order to take the fullness of my will as much as it is possible for a creature, and to know it and to manifest it to others. In other words, Louisa first, and we after her, have to become the eagles of God. And if you examine the eagle has special eyelids to protect it when it's flying into the sun so that it'll still be able to see. And we are protected going into that divine presence to intercede for everybody else. But I love what he's saying here is that you're actually traveling on this ray right to the very source of the ray. And the extraordinary privilege that on behalf of a human race in totally in rebellion against him, that we're allowed to travel on that ray, go into his presence and intercede for them all. It's absolutely magnificent. So for the eagle, I want to give you Proverbs 30, verses 18 and 19. Three things I do not understand. Four, indeed, I don't understand. And one of them is the mystery of the eagle in the sky. And the mystery of the eagle in the sky is, in my opinion, one of the best images that we have of somebody in the divine will actually going right to the source and bringing back life and grace and everything for people who desperately need it but won't thank you because they don't understand. And so it's just divine, really. So it's in the next paragraph that he tells us that the human will was made at the tips of these divine rays. And therefore, since the human will was made, we're meant to travel on those divine rays back into the source. Now, you must know that bonds of identification exist between the divine will and the human will. Identification, he's the sun, we were made on the tips of the rays of that sun. And therefore, why I so much love and want, by right of creation, paternity, love and justice, that the human will would surrender its place to mine, and throwing itself into the arms of the divine will like a little child, that Psalm 131, would let itself be held, nourished and dominated by it. Now, if the human will comes out of the tips of the rays of the divine will, its absolute right place is back on those rays going back to the origin. And that's where it experiences absolutely everything that God intended for it. This is very beautiful stuff. So in creating man, the Supreme Being placed my will out into the field, although all of our attributes concurred with it as a consequence and naturally because of this extraordinary unity. But the Supreme Volition was the primary act by which it took to heart the life of all creation, including man, therefore making itself the life of all. In other words, we don't have life outside of the divine will. We have unlife, we have destruction, we have deformity, we have disgrace, but we don't have life. So the divine will took to heart the life of all creation, including man, and therefore making itself the life of all, dominating everything, making everything its own. Since everything had come out of the divine will, by justice everything was to be its own. It owned everything. More than the sun, my will emitted its rays, and with the tips of these rays animating the human nature, it formed the will of the creature. Now, if you go to Psalm 8 and verse 3, you'll actually find that the ancient people actually knew this because they said, Lord, you created us by the tips of your fingers. Go back to Psalm 8. It's actually very beautiful. So The divine will formed the will of the creature on the tips of these rays. Do you see, therefore, what the will is in the human generations? Many different tips of rays, which were like sparks in the creature to form the will in them. So each one of us is a little spark from God. But without detaching the sparks from the ray unleashed by the center of the sun of the supreme volition. So if each one of us is a tiny spark from one of those rays, that spark cannot exist by itself. It cannot exist outside of its source. And so it's only by going back on those rays right to the very center that we find the fullness of life. So all human generations turn around this sun because each creature contains the tip of one ray of the eternal sun of the divine will. Might be something you might like to write on a piece of paper just for yourself. I am the tip of one ray of the divine will. It's a very beautiful thing. So now, what is not the affront for the sun to see the circumference of these rays whose tipped formed the will of each creature, converted, transmuted into darkness, into human nature, denying the light, denying the dominion and the life of the sun, which gave its will with so much love, so that the divine will and those creatures might be one, and so that the divine will might be able to form divine life in them. We can't have the divine life without the divine will. Can there be a stronger, more stable, more inseparable bond than the one between the center of the sun and its rays? What he's explaining here is the sheer logic of us coming into the divine will. It just doesn't make sense to be outside of it. So that it was intended in our creation that we would have this bond of inseparability with the divine will. Light is indivisible and God is light. So 1 Timothy 6:16, God dwells in unapproachable light. So light is indivisible, and if it could be separated, the detached part would go wandering and would end up turning into darkness. That is exactly what happened to Lucifer. He was an angel of light, absolutely in union with the divine light. And he turned away from that and became darkness. And all of us who turn away from that divine light also become darkness. So I want to give you Ezekiel 28 verses 12 to 19 and Isaiah 14 verses 12 to 15, which describe the fall of Lucifer. And again, they talk about you were there in Eden. You were the one who was so decorated by God. You were so privileged by God. And now look at you. It's incredible. And so if you read those texts from Ezekiel and Isaiah, you'll get a better sense of what's being said here. The sheer disaster of turning away from the light. So there is such union of identification between the divine will and the human as to be comparable to the union that exists between the sun and the solar ray, between the heat and the light. So he goes back to that image of the sun all the time, that we know you cannot separate a ray of light from the sun. It cannot be done. And you cannot separate the heat and the light either. They are completely inseparable. And he says, that was the way we were created. That is our origin. We've got to go back to that inseparability. And then all the light and the glory and the grace and everything that God intended to come into us and through us and out to other people will happen again. And that's how the human race will recover. And the more people who enter into this relationship, the more quickly the human race will recover from its present darkness. So this wonderful identification. Would it not be a right of the sun to dominate its rays and to receive their subjection so as to form the kingdom of light over its solar circumference? So he's just using his own language there on the science of the sun and its rays. So it is for my will. Now, what I'm going to read for you now I read it a number of times before I realised what I was reading. You know, in all the writing we've had up to now, that Louisa finds the deprivation of Jesus completely intolerable. Well, he's now going to tell us that we deprive God and put him into a deprivation which is intolerable for him as well. And it's only when I came to this I said, oh my, now I begin to somehow grasp what is being said. Let's go back a tiny little bit. Would it not be a right of the Son to dominate its rays and to receive their subjection to form the kingdom of light? Okay, so it's the same, he said, for my will. When the creature withdraws from it, now this is the creature depriving God of his rights, depriving God of his privileges. He said, it remains as though without a kingdom, without dominion, without subjects. The divine will feels itself being robbed of that which is its own. Each act which does not depend on its volition is a tearing, a theft made against the light. Now, look at the words that are being used which describe deep pain. A tearing, a theft. And in seeing itself being robbed of its light, converted into darkness, it agonizes. Now, if you take this and then go back and just read everything Louisa has said about how terrifying is the pain she has in the deprivation of Jesus, he is saying that the divine will is caused this terrifying agony by us. It's incredible. The divine will agonizes more than a mother who sees the fruit of her womb being snatched away from her, not to give him life, but to kill him, as in abortion. So, the losses that my will suffers when the creature is not united to its centre and does not live of the volition of its light are divine losses and of infinite value. Therefore, the pain is infinite. The evils for creatures, the ugliness that they acquire, are incalculable and indescribable. And my will remains without a kingdom among the creatures. And they remain stripped of their inheritance with no right to any good whatsoever. Notice, no right. And you'll hear that when we come back into the divine will and go back into that wonderful inseparable union in the divine will, that we regain our rights. So, outside of it, they've no right to any good whatsoever. Therefore, there's nothing more important, nothing greater, which will establish the balance, the order, the harmony, the likeness between the creator and the creature than my will. This is why I want to make known what the divine will is and what the human will is, so that we may reconcile and that my will may acquire its kingdom and the creatures may be given back all the goods that they have lost. Now, that particular message requires a lot of going over it slowly, slowly, slowly to take it in. So September the 9th, 1926, when Jesus speaks, he actually gives what he says. In other words, go back to Genesis, let there be light, and there was light. Okay. So Louisa said, I was thinking, now this is obviously our thinking as well, how much power, how many goods are enclosed in the holy divine will? Because we've just been told that all of these goods are going to flow out on anybody who comes into that permanent union with him. How everything is peace in the divine will and everything is happiness, nor does one need commands in order to operate. Okay. But one's own nature feels so much strength of good within itself that it cannot help doing it. Now she's describing what has happened to her, this utter transformation. Okay. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 13:13, that, you know, in the end, there's faith, hope and love, and the greatest of these is love. I want to give you Romans 13:8-10 as well. So your whole being is transformed to the point that you actually want to do what God wants. What happiness, she says, to feel one's own nature converted into good, into sanctity and into strength. So in the kingdom of the supreme will, there will be no laws, but everything will be love. 1 John 4:7 and following verses, God is love. And one's nature will be converted into divine law in such a way that of its own it will want to do what the supreme fiat wants it to do. So Jeremiah 31, 33 and 34, that the divine law will be written on our hearts and we will know from within. Okay, so she's saying there's going to be no laws, that we will actually operate according to the divine will. So something that we would want to do would be what he wants to do as well. Okay, so watch this now. There are steps in preparation. So while I was thinking of this, beloved Jesus, with his usual light, which he sent forth from his intelligence towards me, that's infused knowledge. My daughter, he said, everything I've told you about my will has been gifts that I've given to you. Knowledge is not enough. You need to underline that about 10 times, because we're studying the volumes and it's very important to study the volumes. But if you leave this as simply information in your head and you're not allowing it to enter into your innermost being to transform you, it's a waste of time. And if you're judged according to your knowledge in the end, you might be in trouble. So knowledge isn't enough. If one does not possess the good which that very knowledge contains. So the whole idea is that you come to know what the Lord is revealing. You reach out for it and you receive it. You take it into yourself. Let it transform you. It becomes part of your history. So that's the way the thing actually works. So knowledge isn't enough if one doesn't possess the good that the knowledge contains. If it were not so, the knowledge would render you unhappy, because it would be telling you about wonderful things you couldn't have. Because knowing a good and not possessing it is always a sorrow. More so, since I do not know how to leave things half done, but only things that are fully and complete, then watch this. Therefore, number one, I dispose the soul. Now, again, this is for your discernment, for yourself, what's going on inside of you. Number one, I dispose the soul. Number two, I expand her capacity. In other words, we start out small, but if we live the bit we know, he expands. To him who has, more will be given until they have more than they have enough. Okay, so the second thing is I expand her capacity. And number three, I give the knowledge together with the good it contains. That's what he wants, is that as we come into this knowledge, we actually take it and we take possession of it and it becomes us. It doesn't become ours, it becomes us. It's actually transformed into us. And since the knowledge of my will is divine, this is why her nature remains endowed with the likeness of the divine nature. So we become more and more and more like God. And more than a daughter, she does not wait for a command, but without being told, feels honored to do what her father does. Okay. It's a very famous statement of St. Augustine, which is gravely misunderstood. It is, love God and do what you like. So it seems to people at a very low level of spirituality that if you give God any attention, then, you know, it's free for all. It's not that. It's that if you enter into this relationship with God, what you want to do is what he wants to do, because there's only one will between the two of you. And there's only one love. There isn't a worldly love mixed with a divine love. There isn't a selfish love mixed with a divine love. There's only one will and only one love. And therefore, what you do is what he wants you to do. So he goes on to tell us, this is the position that there was in the Old Testament, that laws and commands are for servants, for slaves and for rebels. In other words, try and put some order into a community. In the kingdom of the supreme fiat, there are no servants, there are no slaves and there are no rebels. There's only one will. Okay. Now, if you're at the stage of laws and commands, you're in Romans 7, where Paul says, I do the things I don't want to do and I don't do the things I should do. So that's the struggle of someone not come into this extraordinary unity. Okay. I also have here Romans 4 verses 13 to 17. So in the divine will, there's only one will, and that one will is the combination of God and of the creature. The two wills are one. One is completely surrendered to the other. So this is the reason why I'm saying so much and so many things about my will to abound in gifts, not only for you, but for any soul, that includes you and me, who wants to come and live in my kingdom. He wants to pour out gifts in abundance upon us all, so that she may lack nothing for time or eternity. She may need nothing, but possess the source of goods within herself. Now, those of you who are studying the Book of Numbers with me are looking at the very sad situation where the people of God are just not able to come round and trust God to provide everything for them. He wants to give them everything. He wants everything to be gift for them. And no, they want something else. And so we can destroy this simply because we might want something else. But the more we surrender our will to the divine will, it's totally liberating. I mean, it's totally freeing. It's incredible. And you can't help being happy because there's no struggle inside of you. So he said, I would not act as the God that I am, great, powerful, rich and magnanimous, if in having to constitute the kingdom of my will, I did not endow those who live in it with the prerogatives and qualities that my very will possesses. Even more, you must know that just as all things have come out of that single act of God, that singularity, so must everything return to that single act, which is no succession of acts. Now, you've heard me say this in different ways on this journey, and that is, everything came out of this incredible, generous love of God, giving life to the angels, giving life to humanity, giving life. But he wants intelligent beings to come back to him by their own will. He doesn't want slaves. He doesn't want robots. Thank you. Human beings seem to want robots. But he doesn't. He wants someone to come back of their own will. Just think of the joy you have if a small child comes to you, even though they have plucked your favorite rose from the garden and it hasn't been plucked properly, and hands it to you and says, Mummy, I love you, or Granny, I love you, or Daddy, I love you. It's the spontaneous love of that child that is the supreme gift. The rose is merely a symbol of it. It's the fact that the child thought of you and wanted to make this thing. It's the child's will, and it is abounding in love coming back to you. That's what the Lord wants. And I keep saying to you that all of these mysteries are hidden in the tabernacle of the family. They're hidden in the relationships of the spouses and the spouses and their children and the children and the children to the spouses. It's all hidden there, all of these mysteries. It's absolutely fantastic. And if we could get our eyes opened to see in the little things that happen to us that there's something much, much greater actually being revealed to you. And so the Lord wants each one of us, his little children, to come back to him spontaneously with the I love you. That's what he's asking of us. And that's what a child will do spontaneously for the parent or the grandparent. Only one who leaves everything to live of my will can return to that single act. In other words, you can't bring any baggage with you. There isn't any room. The only thing we can take with us back to God is love. Because God is love. So if we want to bring something of me, something of the world, something of the material thing, sorry, you're not getting there. You won't get there. So they have to leave everything. So Deuteronomy 6 verses 4 to 10. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. That's not 99%. All your soul, all your mind, and all your being. That's what the Lord wants, all or nothing. So only somebody who leaves everything can return to that single act, because as the soul lives in the divine will, everything she does converts to light. And that material thing you're holding on to won't convert to light. That stupid opinion that you're sticking on to won't convert to light. That silly selfishness won't convert to light. And her acts are naturally incorporated and identified with the eternal light of the Son of the Divine Will. And as a consequence, they become one single act with the single act of the Divine Will. but it has to be all completely spiritual. The material is out. It has to be all completely spiritual. On the other hand, in one who operates outside of the divine will, one can see not light, but each of the materials that her work contains, which cannot be incorporated into the light or into the single act of God. And therefore, it will show immediately that it's not ours. Not our thing. And it does not belong to us. So anything which is not done by virtue of the divine fiat will not be recognized by God. It's actually that simple. He only wants his own things in his own kingdom. So he's going to give an explanation of that now in the next paragraph. Suppose you wanted to unite light and darkness, copper and gold, rocks and earth. Well, he's giving impossibles there, isn't he? Would one not distinguish with clarity the light from the darkness, the copper from the gold, and the rocks from the earth? And this because these are materials very different from each other. But if you united all together, light with light, darkness with darkness, gold with gold, you would not be able to distinguish nor separate the first from the second. The first darkness from the second one, the first mass of gold from the second. So it is with my will. What it itself does in the creature is light and converts everything into light. And it's no wonder, therefore, that it becomes incorporated into that single act of the eternal light. Therefore, in these times so stormy, with a vertiginous race to evil, vertiginous means a dizzy race to evil, I could not give a greater grace than making known that I want to give the great gift of the kingdom of the supreme fiat. Now, one of the things that the scriptures make very clear, and that is that in the worst of times, God gives the greatest of gifts. That's the amazing thing, and that's what he's doing now as well. And as a confirmation of this, I am preparing the divine will within you with so much knowledge and gifts so that nothing may be lacking to the triumph of my will. Therefore, be attentive on the deposit of this kingdom that I am making in you. So after this, Louisa said that she felt concerned about holy obedience because it had imposed on her not to neglect even one word. This is a very interesting passage, and it's completely different from what we've just read. It's a completely different message altogether. So she had received an obedience not to neglect even one word of that which Jesus was saying to her. And she said, I easily leave them out. Now, she's admitted that all throughout the volumes, that she leaves things out, because I'm convinced it's not necessary to write and to entrust to paper certain intimate things, certain outpourings that Jesus makes to my poor soul, but that they should remain in the depths of the heart. So I was praying that he would give me the grace not to fail the obedience. And Jesus, moving in my interior, gave her a new understanding of obedience, which I think is absolutely fantastic. He said, my daughter, if the one who guides you, who is a priest, your spiritual director, directs you, gives you this obedience, it means that he has understood that it is I who speaks to you. This is a major advance that Jesus is saying. The priests who are guiding Louisa have at long last, it only took 19 volumes, at long last realized it really is Jesus. This is a supernatural thing. This is a mighty step forward. Very important. So they've understood that it is I who speaks to you, as well they've also understood the value of even a single word of mine. Of course, if it's the Lord's word, every single word is extremely important. My word is light and is full of life, and the one who possesses it can give this life and this light. More so, since my word contains the creative. Now, the word used there is strength. I don't think that's use in English. I think we have to say, my word contains the creative power, and therefore a single word of mine can create innumerable lives and grace. You see, to create you need power, and it is the creative power. Okay, so it can create innumerable lives of grace, love, lives of light, lives of my will within souls. Notice even one word. You yourself will not be able to understand the long way that a single word of mine can cover. Sometimes it's just one sentence or one little phrase or one little thing that makes all the difference in a person's life. That is the turning point. That's what he's saying. Those who have ears will listen. That's Matthew 11:15 and Mark 4:9. Those who have ears will listen. Those who have heart will be touched, is what we say in English. Wounded is not the language we use. We use the word wounded for something else. So the one who guides you is right in giving you this obedience. You do not know how I assist him. I remain around him. And while he reads my writings and yours of my will, so as to make him understand all the power of the truths and the great good contained in them. Now, look at what Jesus is saying. To get this priest to understand and grasp the importance of what he's reading, Jesus says, I'm around him, I'm helping him, I'm enlightening him. And he's doing the same with us as well when we come to read and try and understand the writings. He is with us because he's more anxious for us to understand than maybe we are ourselves. And he continues, he turns around my will, and by virtue of the light that he feels, he is sending you this obedience. Therefore, be attentive, and I will help you and facilitate that which is difficult for you. So Jesus continues, you must know that my heart is swollen, it agonizes and it sighs, because I want to make known the kingdom of the supreme fiat, the great goods which are in it, and the great good which those who will possess it will receive. It is precisely in my heart that I keep it. This is a matter of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And I feel my heart explode, for I want to let it out. So we just can't comprehend the infinite love that is actually involved. Don't you want then to give me this relief so that by letting it out, my heart may deflate, in other words, not explode, and so it will not have to agonize and sigh with sorrowful sighs anymore? And you will do this by making it known. Now, notice how we can console the heart of Jesus by making this material known to others. And I manifest to you about my will, because when you do this, you give me the field in order to open the ways and prepare the place in which I must lay the kingdom of my will. In other words, we don't know who's going to respond to this. It's our duty to get this information out, and the mystery that will go on between God and the soul will take over. But if you don't manifest what I say to you, you close the ways and my heart swells even more. Therefore, let me do, follow me, and don't be concerned. So there's an awful lot in what we've shared tonight. You need to take it nice and slowly, piece by piece. So thank you for joining us, and God bless.